Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
None of us know what's going to happen in the future, but I think the resolve that you see expressed by the House and Senate today is going to carry over.
Lawmakers await a decision from Governor Dunleavy on whether to veto the latest education funding bill. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 1st. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Trump wants lower oil prices and more production. Experts say that's a tough combination.
If you drive the price of oil down, you're undermining the economics of projects. We're already seeing that show up.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. A bill boosting education funding, the top priority of the Democrat-heavy coalitions controlling the House and Senate, arrived on the governor's proverbial desk this morning. That's after lawmakers passed House Bill 57 yesterday by a combined vote of 48 to 11. But Governor Mike Dunleavy has not been shy about using his veto pen on education bills. And at least so far, the legislature has come up short of overriding him. This time, though, might be different. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone is here to give us a sense of what the future holds. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Wesley.
So where do things go from here?
So, Wesley, as you said, House Bill 57 has been transmitted to Dunleavy, so he is really in control of what happens next. So he has until May 19th to either sign or veto the bill. Otherwise, according to the Alaska Constitution, it will pass into law automatically.
So let's back up a second. What exactly does House Bill 57 do?
Okay, so the first thing it does is it provides a long-term funding boost to public schools around the state, and that is every kind of public school, regular brick-and-mortar schools like your neighborhood elementary school, but also charter schools, even things like correspondence homeschool and boarding schools. The state has this funding formula for all public schools, and the foundation of that formula is something called the base student allocation. It's the basic funding the state provides for each student. This bill would raise it by $700, and that would change in state law the number that determines how much money schools get from the state and, to some extent, local governments every year. Coalition lawmakers, members of that Democrat-heavy bipartisan caucus, those in the both House and Senate, they say they think schools need actually a lot more money than that, but, you know, with oil prices low right now, money is tight. Of course, the governor could still veto the bill.
And are you expecting him to veto it?
Okay, so that is up in the air. He has been vocal on social media about the various education bills, but he has not said a word about this one publicly, as in when I'm talking to you here Thursday afternoon. But, you know, one thing about this bill is it's not just like a funding boost. If it was, he definitely would veto it. We saw that when he kiboshed House Bill 69. That was a larger funding boost a couple weeks ago. Majority lawmakers negotiated with the minority this time around to cram a bunch more education policy changes into the bill. And that includes a bunch of stuff the governor has said he wants. There's a by default ban on student cell phone use unless the local school board approves something different. There's a boost to school bus and other pupil transportation funding. There are a bunch of changes the governor wanted to charter school laws, things that, you know, make it easier to create one, renew a charter, also changes to the procedures when a school district wants to terminate a charter school. There's also a new program that would financially reward school districts if elementary students do well on reading tests, but only if, and this is a big if a separate tax bill on outside internet-based companies passes. At the same time, though, the governor didn't get everything he wanted out of this bill, at least as of Monday. And at that point, the bill looked pretty similar to the final version that passed on Wednesday. Dunleavy's education commissioner, Dina Bishop, was emailing superintendents and telling them the bill might get vetoed. That is, unless lawmakers made a few more changes to align with Dunleavy's priorities. Bishop's email urged superintendents to reach out to their legislators and tell them that. At least one superintendent actually did. That's according to a co-chair of the House Education Committee. Although, you know, she says it didn't actually change her mind. Anyway, the bill might get vetoed or it might not. But lawmakers say they're confident it will become law one way or another.
And what's making lawmakers so confident? I mean, we last saw them come up one vote short last year on another pretty big education compromise bill that the governor ended up vetoing.
Yeah, that's right. So the lessons of Senate Bill 140, that's that old bill, those are still fresh in a lot of folks' minds. And, you know, it's been another year of, like, dire warnings from school leaders saying they're looking at, like, deep cuts to programs and staff that a lot of people like. There was also an election last November where education funding was the number one issue for a lot of people. And, you know, also at this point, we have a lot of people coming out publicly and saying they will override the governor if it comes down to it. Six minority Republicans have told me they would vote to override, and that would be enough to get to the 40-vote threshold, assuming, you know, all 35 members of the House and Senate majorities would vote to override. And these are not just moderates, right? These are real-deal conservatives, people who, you know, tend to side with Dunleavy on a lot of things. Heck, yesterday I was in the hallway talking with Representative Sarah Vance. She is a very conservative Republican from Homer who has been an ally of Governor Dunleavy. And even she is saying that she would vote to override, though, of course, you know, she told me she's planning to try to talk the governor into not vetoing it. You know, she told me she hopes it doesn't come to that, but she says she would.
And why would Vance vote to override?
Well, so Sarah Vance says she thinks the policies embedded in the bill will actually make a big difference in how well the state's students do. And the thing is, you know, if this bill doesn't pass, we'd probably end up with another year of one-time funding without all of these policies attached. So, yeah, I mean, that's how she's thinking about it.
So the big question, is there a veto-proof majority for this bill?
Well, yes and no, or maybe yes and maybe. So if lawmakers stick to their public statements, there are, you know, it seems like 40 plus votes to override the veto on House Bill 57. But, and this is a pretty big caveat, that is not the only way Dunleavy could prevent the bill from taking effect, or at least, you know, the funding boost part of it. Alaska's Constitution actually gives Dunleavy immense power over state spending. He has a line item veto power. So even if they change the base student allocation in state law, that number in the formula, it's possible that Dunleavy could veto the funding behind that number. That would, you know, be unprecedented, and some House Democratic leaders say it could be unconstitutional, although that is very debatable. But Dunleavy has been a big proponent of following formulas in state statute. You know, when it comes to the permanent fund dividend, he says things like, you know, the formula is the law, and I'm going to follow the law. That is a, you know, kind of a whole nother discussion. But, you know, on that subject, here's House Speaker Bryce Edgman. He's a Dillingham independent.
Well, if House 57 becomes law, the governor would then be, you know, not observing the law. You know, none of us know what's going to happen in the future. But I think the resolve that you see expressed by the House and the Senate today is going to carry over and will not go away.
And to overcome a veto of the funding, that takes a three-quarters majority, or 45 votes. There is a lot of distance between 40 and 45, even though we saw 48 lawmakers vote for this, you know, bill the first time around. Not everybody's saying they're going to come out and override. Some folks are not saying that. There's also the issue of timing. An override vote on House Bill 57, you know, could actually happen during the legislative session. He has to sign or veto it by May 19th, 2 days before the session ends. A budget veto override would have to happen a lot later, you know, weeks or months after lawmakers leave Juneau, so that is up in the air. But honestly, Wesley, you know, having been here last year when the last education compromise was vetoed and the override failed, you know, it just kind of feels different this time around. Whether it actually is different this time around or not, we will have to see.
Well, that's Eric Stone, Alaska Public Media's legislative reporter in Juneau. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska Pacific University posthumously honors Alaska flag designer Benny Benson.
We Alaskans are proud of our flag. Our state song echoes the words that young Benny submitted with his very design.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Fort Wainwright and the contractor that owns and operates the installation's heat and power plant are investigating the cause of a fire and smoldering hotspots that occurred earlier this week in the coal that fuels the facility. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Post spokesperson Cole Keller said in a news release Wednesday that no injuries were reported, and he said the plant continued operating while firefighters worked for several hours to extinguish Monday's blaze. Keller said in a news release that investigators haven't yet determined the cause of the fire that broke out in the power plant's coal tower. That structure houses the conveyor system that transports coal from rail cars to coal bunkers up on the sixth floor of the plant. It's stored there until it's fed into the boilers. The plant generates up to 22 megawatts of electricity as well as steam to heat the post. Keller said investigators think the fire probably occurred because the coal had been exposed to air while being loaded into the facility. He said the plant's fire suppression system helped detect and extinguish the fire in hot spots. The Fairbanks Fire Department dispatched personnel and equipment to help Fort Wainwright's emergency responders gain control of the situation, and he said the investigators don't yet have an estimate on what it'll cost to repair the damage. Fairbanks-based Doyon Utilities, which owns the plant, said in the news release Wednesday that the fire broke out in a system that collects dust that's generated by transporting coal into and within the plant. The dust collector is located adjacent to the conveyor system. Keller said the last time fire broke out in the power plant was in 2018, but there have been other problems with the 70-year-old facility that have required operators to reduce or temporarily halt power generation. For KUAC News, I'm Tim Ellis.
Since President Trump took office, the price of a barrel of oil from Alaska has declined about 10%, and the Trump administration would like the price to drop even more. The administration has called for $50 per barrel oil as an effort to curb inflation, but Trump also wants to develop more natural resources in Alaska. Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports.
An executive order he signed on his first day back in office is titled, quote, Unleashing Alaska's Extraordinary Resource Potential. It calls for new oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and building roads to mining sites in rural Alaska. Longtime oil and gas analyst Brad Keithley says those two goals, to develop more resources and lower the price of oil, are at odds.
I mean, if you drive the price of oil down, you're undermining the economics of projects. We're already seeing that show up in the fracking plays, seeing it show up in terms of reduced investment, reduced production, reduced drilling as the price of oil has gone down.
But oil is also the largest component of Alaska's economy, and Keithley says falling prices could have a big impact on oil companies in the state.
But if Trump is successful driving the short-term price of oil down, you know, he will do things to try to keep the short-term price of oil price down. And that will, you know, affect the economics of the projects that people are evaluating.
The oil and gas industry supports about a quarter of Alaska jobs, according to the Resource Development Council. President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, Kara Moriarty, says she's excited about the president's goal to develop Alaska resources. She says it's a welcome change from the Biden administration. And she says it is still possible with lower oil prices.
As the administration is trying to focus on unleashing access, improved regulatory process, and infrastructure, all of those things can also help with the cost of doing business.
Moriarty says the Trump administration's goal to streamline the regulatory process will save companies money. But she says when the price of oil drops, the industry will constrict spending and limit investing in new development.
I mean, the only thing we can guarantee about price is it's going to go up and it's going to go down, and we never know when that's going to be. I think the challenge for Alaska when it does come to price, however, is that Alaska is such an expensive place to do business.
Moriarty says the average cost to transport a barrel of oil from the North Slope to Valdez is over $9 a barrel. She says it costs even more to get a barrel from the ground to the pipeline, about $35. Add those up, and it doesn't leave companies much room to make a profit if oil dips to $50. Moriarty says companies will restrict exploration work first.
Because they don't have any money coming in. You know, the fields that are already invested in and already producing, those fields can kind of weather a little bit better the price swings of the industry. And the industry's kind of built on that.
For much of 2020, oil prices were below the $50 threshold and even fell to negative levels for a short period. The state lost more than 3,000 oil and gas jobs that year. But oil hasn't fallen below $50 since early 2021, according to data from the EIA. If that happens again, retired state economist Neil Fried says the severity of impacts largely depend on how low prices get and for how long.
I mean, if they last a year, you can probably get through it. You know, they might last for years. For example, the 90s, where we had low oil prices for so long, we lost all kinds of jobs. And even though the state got through it, it was pretty tough.
Fried says high-quality oil prices are the most important thing when it comes to investment and growth in the industry. With help from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, I'm Ava White.
For weeks, much of the chatter in Haines, on Facebook, in coffee shops, on Main Street, has revolved around one question. Are the hooligan here? By high tide early this week, the small oily fish had arrived in full force. But as Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, a slew of other questions about the run remain unanswered despite its immense value in the Upper Lynn Canal.
Sonny Williams is posted up on a bridge that straddles the Chilkoot River, 9 miles outside Haines. The sky is dark and spitting rain, and a cacophony of birds circle above the water. Sea lions bellow downstream.
Lots of hooligans, huh?
They're all here for one reason. The hordes of small black fish that wriggle through the water below. Williams points as a school makes its way upstream. Then, in one swift motion, they spiral into another school that's headed back toward the ocean.
You know, you'll see them there going up and down, getting their bodies acclimating to the fresh water.
Williams has lived in the Chilkat Valley and harvested hooligan here all his life. Also known as Ulikon and Sock and Clinket, the fish return to the area to spawn each spring. And for millennia, the Chilkoot and Chilkat Clinket have harvested the fish and extracted their oil to trade for other goods. Some years, the run is thick. Others, it's lighter, or never arrives at all in some places. Why exactly that happens remains uncertain, as does a long list of other questions about the species that experts say is understudied and underregulated, which is why Williams started keeping his own records about 2 decades ago.
Nobody was recording when they were coming, what days they were coming on the Chilkat side and coming over here, and I was doing that.
The information is crucial, he says, for one reason.
I wanted to protect it. We need to protect it for future generations to come.
Williams is still taking notes, but now so are a handful of researchers across the region in partnership with the Chilkoot Indian Association. The tribe launched a study in 2010 to start tracking the run, says Meredith Pocart, who helps facilitate the study.
Yeah, it started like from tribal members just wanting to know, like have more kind of concrete data about how our runs were doing up here. And the reason behind that was that runs further south were dramatically declining. And
every day, she heads to the Chilkoot River to take samples, including on a windy, cold morning earlier this week. After a short hike out to the water, she kneels down and fills bottles. Later, the samples will be filtered and sent to an out-of-state lab to analyze the hooligan DNA in the water. The data helps track the size of the run, when it arrives, and how long it lasts. But as is often the case with research, Pocart says there's still more questions than answers.
So they're probably 5 or 6 years old, but we don't really know. We also don't really know if they spawn more than once. There's evidence that kind of leans in both directions.
While Pocart wraps up the sampling, a massive goals lifts off from a nearby bank. Cellar sea lions huff in the distance. It's an impressive show of the run's immense ecological value, Pocart says.
This is like the buffet is open. You look on are a forage fish, the base of a food web, and so it's what supports all of this other life that's so...
Take sea lions, which forage on Ulikon just before the females give birth. But if they can't access the nutrient-dense fish this time of year, it can thwart their ability to nurse their young. Stacey Evans is the science director of a nonprofit that partners with the tribe to sample hooligan DNA on the Chilkat River. But Evans also checks on other species' activity during the run. One day last week, she estimated that more than 50,000 gulls were there to feast before migrating further north.
Yeah, it's just like life coming back to the valley in such a big way. I've really never seen anything quite like it anywhere else. I've worked in a lot of cool places.
Back on the bridge over the Chilkoot, the fish are coming in thick. Williams rushes to grab his bucket and walks down to the riverbank. He swings the throw net into the water. When he pulls the net back, it's heavy with fish, enough to fill his small blue cooler in one go. Tomorrow, he says, he'll fillet and smoke just the males, and then eat about one a day until this time next year. On the banks of the Chilkat and Chilkoot rivers in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
Salt brine is one way the Alaska Department of Transportation treats Kenai Peninsula roadways in the winter. Thousands of people and the Borough Assembly have pushed back against the use of the somewhat corrosive mixture, but as KDLL's Hunter Morrison reports, one Seward High School freshman was recognized for introducing a road treatment alternative.
The idea all started with a school project about black ice on Alaska's roadways. That led Seward High's Hannah Leatherman down a research rabbit hole. She found that while salt brine is a low-cost way to clear ice off roads, it may be corrosive and may attract wildlife, like moose. So she came up with an alternative to road brine, a thermal asphalt mix.
It's just a cleaner way of preventing ice formation.
Leatherman pitched her idea earlier this month to Caring for the Kenai, an annual environmental awareness contest for Kenai Peninsula High School students. Her project won first prize. The salt brine replacement idea would add graphite nanoplatelets to already existing roads. Leatherman says the material is non-toxic and has heating additives that can prevent ice buildup. Unlike salt, this stuff doesn't attract moose or other animals. So, she says it can also reduce wildlife vehicle collisions. Leatherman hopes her project will one day make it to wintry roads on the Kenai Peninsula. Although there's no official plan to incorporate the idea on local roads, Leatherman hopes that'll one day change.
I just really hope that with time I will be able to hopefully implement this new mix everywhere.
Leatherman's winning project came with a $2,000 cash prize. She plans to either put the money in a savings account or invest it in Graphite One. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
Benny Benson, the designer of Alaska's state flag, was recognized over the weekend with a posthumous honorary doctorate from Alaska Pacific University. The move comes almost a century after Benson's unlikely win in a statewide design contest for Alaska schoolchildren. It's also happening during an ongoing push from historians to recognize his cultural heritage as Ununga from the Aleutian Islands. KUCB's Andy Lusk has the story.
It's not unheard of to see crowds welcoming arrivals at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. When soldiers and veterans make the long trek home, or a sitting president visits the last frontier, Alaskans come together to give them a proper greeting. But today's arrival is unique. Darren Herman has just landed. He's the grandson of Benny Benson. He exits to a crowd cheering, singing the Alaska flag song, waving the iconic blue and gold-starred banner, and performing traditional Ununga dances. He knew there would be a reception, but not how big it would be.
I can't even put words to it. I would have never dreamt anything like this. This is awesome. It's crazy.
Herman is from North Dakota, but has deep family roots in Alaska. His grandfather was the boy who overcame unlikely odds and prejudice to become the first and only known Native person to design an American state flag. Benson died in 1972 at age 59 and is now receiving an honorary doctorate in humane letters. Herman is here for the ceremony. It's his first time visiting the state, and his schedule is packed thanks to his guide.
I know Mike's got a lot of ideas and stuff that he wants me to try to do, so I'll probably just follow him.
Mike Livingston is a regional historian whose work centers on overlooked Alaska Native stories in the Aleutians and beyond. He spent years researching Benson's life and heritage. He was the lead author of a 2022 paper that sought to correct a misconception that Benson was Aleutic or Supiak, not Ununga. Livingston pushed to have Benson posthumously enrolled as a member of the Kamilungan tribe of Unalaska, which was approved the same day Benson's grandson landed in Alaska. Livingston says Benson receiving an honorary doctorate is pretty dang cool.
He really should have received it when he was still with us, but it's never too late to correct wrongs.
Benson grew up in the Jesse Lee Home for Children, a boarding school in Unalaska that later moved to Seward. He experienced firsthand discrimination during the flag design contest when a panel of judges, some of whom were members of the Seward Press, wrote offensive things about him on the basis of his ethnicity. This lit a spark in him, and in the 1960s, he successfully advocated for his inclusion in the Kodiak Elks Lodge, opening the door for other Alaska Natives to join the Elks. Livingston calls Benson a positive role model.
He was a brave young man who stayed in the contest and won the contest. If it hadn't been for Benny, we just probably would have another boring state flag with a blue background and a state seal in the middle of it, like half the state flags are, just really, really boring.
At the commencement, over 100 graduates are being recognized, including Benson. Alaska Pacific University President Janelle Vanas credited his contributions to the state.
Today, we Alaskans are proud of our flag. Our state song echoes the words that young Benny submitted with his very design. We have our flag because of Benny's resolve.
The room is packed with family and friends of the graduates, many of whom are Alaska Native themselves. Herman walks on stage and accepts his grandfather's doctorate. After the ceremony, Herman says, as busy as it was, his first visit to Alaska was awesome and a learning experience.
A lot of the stuff's new to me, and it's great to hear the story and be part of it.
Reporting for KUCB, with help from Adeline Baxter, I'm Andy Lusk.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Ava White in Anchorage, Hunter Morrison in Kenai, Avery L. Felton Haynes, and Andy Lusk in Unalaska. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.